Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back here on The Punch Out, 18th of January, 2022. Playing for you here on the show, as we always do. We're going to be talking about what's currently happening in Ethiopia. We're also going to be talking about the ongoing struggle in Sudan. But before we get to either of those two very important stories, we want to start with another very important story on the African continent. That's in the nation of Mali, where people are rising in a major way against sanctions. Those were sounds from the huge mass rally that took place in the capital of Mali, Bamako, last Friday, the 14th of January. The rally was called by the current transitional government in opposition to sanctions on Mali by the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, denouncing them as part of a broader effort led by France to maintain neocolonial control over the country. Without a doubt, the majority of anger in the crowd was aimed directly at France. The ECOWAS states have closed their borders and stopped flights to Mali, as well as stopped other forms of economic exchange with the country, including blocking access to West Africa's central bank, to attempt to pressure the Malian government to hold elections this year after they announced recently that the transition period would last for 5 years, with a constitutional referendum in 2023, a legislative election in 2025, and a presidential election in 2026. ECOWAS has stated this violates the bloc's rules around quote-unquote democracy, which they say the Malian government has failed to meet since taking power in a 2020 coup. That coup was sparked by huge mass protest against the then-current government and French neocolonialism. However, the announcement of sanctions appears to be less than independent on ECOWAS's part and comes right on the heels of major denunciations of Mali by France, the EU, the UK, and the US for creating an alliance with Russia to improve its military capabilities, Mali, that is, and the long-running insurgency in the north and now central parts of the country that's been raging since 2012. Mali is now set to file a formal complaint against the ECOWAS sanctions, but ECOWAS has gained the backing of the EU and at least tacitly other Western states, so the prospect of sanctions being lifted seems fairly slim, at least for now. Mali was also stripped of its preferential access to U.S. markets earlier this year, in another Western attempt to pressure the nation. Without access to the central bank, Mali will struggle to raise cash and could quickly run out of money for state salaries and other transactions, which, as we've seen recently with Afghanistan, can send a country into a downward spiral economically, and this in a country where already 42% of the nation lives in extreme poverty. Reports are that Mali has 3 months left of cash in the bank, and that the country's fairly large gold industry could also provide some cash as well because it continues to operate. The gold industry is able to operate because Guinea, Mali's neighbor, is the one ECOWAS country which has refused to abide by the sanctions and is offering landlocked Mali the access it needs to continue to export. This is notable because Guinea, too, has a military government that took power in a coup that was quite popular with the Guinean street, who had been massively protesting over attempts by the then president to stay for a third term and his economic bungling, which had caused even more hardship than already existed. Guinea's military-led transitional government also is planning on a fairly extended transition period, like Mali, and also like Mali and Ethiopia, lost its preferential access to U.S. markets earlier this year. Taking one step back then, it's important to view what's happening in Mali and Guinea in a broader context. West Africa in general has seen a marked rise in sentiment against French neocolonialism, which has a stranglehold on the whole region. And it's also deeply interconnected with anger towards the U.S. and IMF World Bank apparatus, much the same thing, all of which has delivered dismal living standards. Increasingly, people in West Africa are fed up. In Mali and Guinea, coups have taken place that at least speak to this mass anger. So the question is, will these coup governments actually do anything different than any of the previous governments to actually improve the lives of their people? That we don't know. But for now, we can understand the anger of Western powers and their proxies in Africa, with these military governments as representing a fear that African nations are starting to slip away from being totally under the thumb of powers in Washington, Paris, Brussels, and London. What you just heard comes from protests in Khartoum, Sudan, yesterday, when the 14th round of mass demonstrations against the October 25th military coup in Sudan took place. The protests, known as Marches of Millions, once again took place all across the country against a backdrop of serious repression and violence from state forces. At least 7 were killed and over 100 injured in Khartoum when a march to the presidential palace was fired on with live rounds. Footage has emerged of Sudanese state forces firing anti-aircraft weapons at protesters, as well as gassing and beating them. A number of journalists have been arrested, and Al Jazeera's Sudan bureau was reportedly shut down as well. The protests were less widespread, and their size was significantly smaller in many places than some of the past events because of fears that ultimately seem to have materialized here that the state was going to amp up not just repression in the most general sense, but outright murders in the specific sense. Somewhat amazingly, this happened while the United Nations has a major mission in Khartoum, allegedly trying to mediate the broader political crisis. The overall situation is this. In 2019, huge mass protests swept Sudan and overthrew the previous government that had ruled for the past 30 years. A segment of that government in the military jumped ship and formed a transitional government with the Forces for Freedom and Change, which contained a number of political parties and organizations, which played a big role in the protest. That government, however, quickly lost favor with the populace. This happened for a range of reasons, but mainly the transitional government wasn't performing very well, economic hardship was increasing, the government was at least proposing to adopt harsh austerity measures, and had mortgaged the country's foreign policy for cash and debt relief by signing up to normalize relations with Israel, in a very pro-Palestinian country, and agreeing to act as a stalking horse for U.S. interest in Ethiopia. So on October 25th, the military launched a coup and decided to get rid of the civilian component of the government, which it viewed as too unwilling to proceed with austerity measures and too overzealous trying to claw back wealth gained from corrupt practices. Almost immediately, the grassroots resistance committees sprung into action, unleashing huge mass demonstrations across the entire country, which brings us to our current moment. The demonstrations are so huge, broad, and widely supported, it has made it impossible for the military to really govern, even with the allies it has cobbled together from several former armed insurgencies in Darfur and several other places. However, the mass movement in the streets is against any sort of military rule and wants an all-civilian government to lead the transition to elections in 2023, one that has real involvement from the resistance committees at the grassroots. The U.S., the U.K., the EU, and Gulf states all supported the coup, well, soft supported the coup, and have ended up in a bit of a bind here. They don't want to be seen as openly supporting the coup, but they also don't want to totally lose the military, who is the main force within the current moment, who is willing to toe the line on what are clearly going to be unpopular policies, both domestically and internationally. Notably, the junta has started to impose an increase in electricity prices, which has sparked protests by northern farmers. And presumably the junta is doing this to show that they are 100% on board with the imperialist agenda, come what may. So essentially, you've got two totally diametrically opposed positions, and you've got these countries in the West and in the Gulf states trying to bridge that gap by saying, let's go back to 2019 and the original civilian military agreement. But of course, as we mentioned, the protest movement 100% against that. So the UN has stepped in to try to bridge that gap somehow, some way, and there are a number of different proposals coming from political parties, resistance committees, and others that they're trying to find a way to harmonize, but the gap seems essentially unbridgeable because the masses of people are rejecting any return to the past agreements of 2019, and the military seems to not be that concerned with making much of a deal. The junta is clearly escalating repression to attempt to bludgeon the movement on the streets and their political representatives into accepting a deal that is, well, more favorable to them, the military government, that is. Whether or not that's possible is also unclear, and the level of determination by people to stay in the streets seems very high if it's certainly facing increasing repression. So for now, there's quite an impasse. Ultimately, there's a test of wills between the two sides, which really means the ultimate outcome in Sudan will depend on whether or not the bullets and the beatings can break the spirit of the millions marching. In just a couple days, the new U.S. envoy for the Horn of Africa, David Satterfield, and the Undersecretary of State for Africa, Mali Fee, are headed to Ethiopia. The pair are traveling to Addis Ababa in what appears to be an attempt to reset relations, at least to some degree, after the U.S. spent the last year supporting a regime change operation launched by the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, also a former very close ally of the U.S. during the 30 years they ruled Ethiopia, before being turfed out in 2018 after opposition to their rule became so significant, even their own coalition partners turned on them. The visit follows a January 10th call from President Biden to Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. The call was quite surprising, as Biden had deliberately avoided it for some time, including not calling Abiy to congratulate him on his election. The call actually mentioned this idea of the upcoming trip, so more or less organized at least the initial piece of it, and Biden, in fact, asked for the call with Dr. Abiy. So clearly it represented a broader attempt to give some energy to restoring the frayed relations between the two countries. Some have adopted a very optimistic attitude, saying that all these actions are very hopeful signs that the U.S. has seen their strategy is failing and is coming around to the Ethiopian government way of seeing things. Others are more cautious and, well, count me in the very cautious camp. Biden's call elicited a flurry of rhetorical activity, with a number of key senators also offering fairly upbeat takes on the call and generally echoing Biden's stance and tone. In a more extended Q&A, an administration spokesperson also noted the U.S. was open to reconsidering the removal of Ethiopia from AGOA, which offers preferential access to U.S. markets. So why am I so skeptical, you might add, especially given the fact that the war seems to be shifted against the TPLF and U.S. policy looks at a dead end. So if they're attempting to make nice, it must mean they want to turn things around, right? Not so fast. The place to start in terms of my reservations is the upshot of U.S. language. The U.S. position at the end of the day is for the TPLF to play a role in a post-war structure. Whether we're talking about the White House or Congress, the U.S. statements focus on the need to have a negotiated ceasefire based on current positions, which means that the TPLF would stay where they are, including land they seized, and humanitarian aid would start to flow in, which, as we've seen already, they're using for military purposes, so they would become strengthened. Implicitly there, obviously, is that the TPLF would be allowed to stay where they are and thus continue to control Tigray. And since they've shown that that's not enough for them, they want to have a bigger role in the broader national governing structure. The end result of any negotiations and talks would have to be them playing some role in the broader political scene that has a significant amount of power, at least enough to make them feel this war was worthwhile. So at the end of the day, the U.S. position is still to preserve the TPLF negotiating position to allow them to leverage the military campaign that they have waged, as destructive as it's been, in order to get back something they lost based on the popular will of the people of Ethiopia, which is some level of control over the country. And this is only further reinforced by what I said earlier about the role of propaganda. The U.S. is continuing to harp on Ethiopian military operations needing to stop, especially airstrikes and drone strikes, offering only really the most veiled acknowledgments that the TPLF continues to shell and attack places in Amhara and Afar. They also have made essentially zero comments addressing the massive destruction that has been widely reported on, including by BT News, in areas that were under TPLF occupation. So the use of propaganda is the same as it's been since the beginning of the conflict, to soft-pedal TPLF actions in order to help improve their image vis-a-vis the Ethiopian government and thus improve their negotiating position. If the U.S. was really changing its position, you'd think you'd see some more substantial change here, more direct denunciation of the TPLF and their actions, perhaps even suggestions that they disarm or further withdraw, at least leave the areas of Amhara that they are currently in and stop the attacks on Afar, that they would be saying that directly and forthrightly. And you'd also probably see more forthright acknowledgement of the Ethiopian position on humanitarian aid. But we haven't seen any of that. So far, all we've seen is the U.S. trying to rescue the substance of a totally failed policy by acting a little nicer and acting a little less absurdly. But at the end of the day, the core of that policy remains the same: to disrupt the process unleashed in 2018 that is moving away from the TPLF U.S. strategy of divide and rule in the Horn of Africa. Overall, the U.S. feels a more united horn is a threat to its interest and is still working to control the process to the maximum degree possible. That isn't good. It's not hopeful. Because as they've proven time and time again, the U.S. establishment does not have a positive vision for the Horn of Africa. It has a vision based on maintaining a favorable balance of power in a geostrategic region. Until that changes, there isn't much reason to assume a shift in U.S. attitudes means a positive shift for the people of the Horn. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York, East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles, Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.